Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are taking a close look at a really influential book. It's one that, well, it shapes so much how governments think, how businesses act, even how we figure out right and wrong personally. We're talking about John Stuart Mill's utilitarianism.
Absolutely. It's a cornerstone of ethical thinking. You often hear it boiled down to, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number.
Right, that phrase.
But that's just the surface, really. It's deceptively simple. Mill actually dedicated, what, 5 chapters to building this incredibly sophisticated and sometimes quite surprising defense of that very principle.
So our mission today, for you listening, is to get past that sort of bumper sticker version. We want to unpack Mill's actual arguments, his nuances. He put forward this greatest happiness principle, not just as an idea, but as a rational, humane, and importantly, practical standard for morality.
And it's just so relevant still. I mean, think about it. When we debate how to allocate resources, maybe during a health crisis, or setting up social programs, or even grappling with, say, AI ethics.
Oh, yeah.
The underlying logic judging actions by their consequences for everyone's well-being, that's pure utilitarianism in action. It's become a default yardstick for so many complex, modern ethical choices.
Okay, so let's talk about the man himself. John Stuart Mill, born 1806, died 1873. He wasn't just a philosopher. He was this, like, towering figure, political economist, even a high-ranking civil servant. But his backstory, it's almost like philosophical engineering.
It really is, isn't it? He was basically raised by the system he was set to inherit and champion. His father, James Mill, and Jeremy Bentham, the guy who basically founded modern utilitarianism, they designed his education.
Designed it.
Completely. We're talking Greek at age 3, Latin, logic, political economy, all mastered at an age most kids are just, you know, learning basic arithmetic. He was literally molded to be the ultimate rational thinker.
That intense rationality is so key. But what makes his take on utilitarianism really stand out, I think, isn't just that he inherited it. It's that he felt he had to change it, to humanize it, after hitting a personal wall.
That's the absolute crucial turning point. Mill had this severe mental health crisis in his early 20s, a breakdown, essentially.
Yeah.
And he realized that the version of utilitarianism he'd been taught, Bentham's version, which was all about rationally calculating pleasure and pain, it felt cold, emotionally sterile. It didn't account for, like, the value of poetry or art or deep human feelings.
So it wasn't enough just to calculate.
Exactly. And that crisis transformed him. It forced him to become a reformer of the theory from within. He realized that for utilitarianism to actually work for humans, happiness couldn't just be about quantity of pleasure. Quality had to matter a lot.
Which brings us right to the heart of the book, doesn't it? The main argument defending this greatest happiness principle. Mill states it pretty clearly. Actions are right if they tend to promote happiness, which he defines as pleasure in the absence of pain, and they're wrong if they produce the opposite.
And his goal was huge. He wasn't just tweaking an idea. He wanted to provide a single rational foundation for all of morality, grounded purely in human well-being, something to replace, you know, relying on religious dogma or abstract philosophical rules nobody could agree on. He wanted a standard we could actually test and apply.
But you can immediately see the problem, right? As soon as you base morality on pleasure, people jump up and shout. Well, they use the phrase doctrine worthy of swine.
Yep, that was the big early criticism. The accusation was that utilitarianism just encourages us to chase base physical pleasures, like pigs rolling in mud, basically.
Pretty harsh.
Very. And Mill's response to that is what makes his version so groundbreaking, his key innovation. He drew this firm distinction between higher and lower pleasures. He absolutely refused to let the theory be dismissed as just about physical gratification.
So how did he define higher?
Intellectual, aesthetic, moral pleasures, things involving our minds, our creativity, our empathy. By valuing these, by saying they are inherently better, he aimed to make the theory compatible with human dignity. This distinction really elevates the whole system.
Okay, so let's dig into how he tackles these challenges chapter by chapter, starting with that pig objection. How does he actually prove that, say, reading philosophy is better than just having a feast?
Right, that's chapter 2 territory. He introduces the competent judge test. He agrees happiness is pleasure and no pain, but then he makes this crucial move, arguing that some kinds of pleasure are just qualitatively superior.
And a proof.
It's experiential. He says, look, the only way to know which of two pleasures is better is to ask someone who has actually experienced both.
Makes sense.
And Mill claims, based on his observation of human nature, that anyone who has experienced both intellectual, moral, or aesthetic pleasures and purely physical ones will always, always choose the life that engages their higher faculties.
Even if that life has more struggles.
Yes. They wouldn't trade their capacity for higher thought and feeling, even if it comes with dissatisfaction, for a life of simple, ignorant contentment.
And this leads to maybe the most famous line in the whole book.
Absolutely. It is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied.
Yeah, that really lands.
It's his mic drop moment on that issue. It firmly states that the goal isn't just maximizing any old pleasure. It's maximizing the highest kind of human flourishing. Depth over shallow contentment.
Okay, quality established. But then there's that nagging question. Motivation. Why should I care about the general happiness? Why not just look out for number one, especially if no one's looking?
Oh, yes. Chapter 3 tackles this. This is where Mill brings in conscience and sanctions, and it makes the theory feel, well, a bit warmer, less calculating. He acknowledges external things matter, laws, punishment, reputation.
Sure, the obvious stuff.
But he argues the real force, the internal glue holding morality together, is the internal sanction, conscience.
But he doesn't think conscience is, like, built in, God-given or something.
No, and that's key. He thinks it's cultivated. It's a moral feeling that grows out of our fundamental social feelings. Our natural desire, he believed, is for unity with other people.
So it's learned, developed?
Yes. As civilization progresses, as we become more educated and empathetic, we naturally start to see our own good as tied up with the good of the whole society. And when we act against that, when we harm the collective good, we feel that internal pang conscience. So it's rooted not just in logic, but in our psychology and social nature.
Okay, so we have quality, we have motivation. What about proof? This is always tricky in philosophy, right? How do you prove your foundational principle? Mill admits you can't logically deduce it. So what's his move?
He says, look, you can't offer a strict logical proof for a first principle. You can only offer considerations, evidence that might persuade someone. And he uses this famous and frankly quite controversial analogy.
The one about seeing and desiring.
That's the one. He says, the only evidence it is possible to produce that anything is desirable is that people do actually desire it.
Okay. Unpack that a bit.
His logic, or analogy rather, is the only proof that something is visible is that people actually see it. So by analogy, the only proof something is desirable, meaning good, worth wanting, is that people actually do desire it.
And since everyone desires their own happiness, then the sum total of everyone's happiness, the general happiness must be desirable, must be a good for the aggregate, for everyone together. Now, philosophers have poked holes in this for ages. Yeah, I can see the leap there. Just because people do desire something doesn't automatically mean they should, or that it's truly good.
Exactly. The classic is-ought problem. But Mill's aim was to ground ethics firmly in observable human experience, in what people actually want, rather than abstract commands.
Right. Okay, last big hurdle, and it's a major one. Justice. This is the classic objection, isn't it? That utilitarianism could justify doing something awful, like punishing an innocent person, if it somehow led to the greater good for more people. How does Mill square that circle? How does he protect individual rights?
This is chapter 5, and it's brilliant, really. It's his ultimate synthesis. He argues that justice isn't some separate competing moral principle that trumps utility. Instead, justice is simply the name we give to certain types of utility specifically, those rules and rights that are absolutely essential for social stability and individual security.
So things like fairness, not being harmed unjustly, having contracts respected, these aren't anti-utility.
Quite the opposite. Mill says security failing safe, knowing there are rules, being able to trust others and institutions is the most fundamental prerequisite for any kind of stable happiness.
It's like the foundation everything else is built on.
Precisely. If a society starts violating basic rules of justice, even for some supposed short-term gain, it erodes trust, creates fear, and ultimately undermines the possibility of long-term happiness for everyone. The damage is immense. So protecting justice, upholding rights, becomes the highest utilitarian priority. Justice is simply the most vital, most important class of social utility.
Okay, that's a really powerful way to frame it. So boiling it down, what are the main takeaways, the core messages Mill leaves us with?
I think there are a few key ones. First, definitely that qualitative distinction of pleasures. It's not just about more pleasure, but better pleasure. It insists we aim for intellectual, moral growth, human flourishing, not just contentment.
Yeah, that feels central. What else now?
Second, the idea of harmony between individual and social good. Mill was optimistic that through education and social progress, caring about the general welfare could become, like second nature, part of our own happiness. Personal growth and social progress linked.
And third, maybe the scientific character of ethics. He treated morality like something we could study and improve through reason and evidence.
Exactly. Not fixed dogma, but a field where we learn from experience what actually works to make people's lives better. It's a very forward-looking approach, contrasting sharply with static moral systems.
And finally, that crucial point about justice. Justice is grounded in security. Rights aren't obstacles to the greater good. They are the essential framework for the greater good, for long-term social trust and happiness.
Those four really capture the essence of his refined utilitarianism, I think.
The book is also full of really quotable lines that crystallize these ideas. Let's revisit a few. First, the basic principle. Actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness.
That's the core definition. Pure consequentialism, judge the act by its results for happiness.
Then the famous defense of quality. It is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied.
Yeah, that just perfectly captures the idea that a life striving for meaning and understanding is inherently more valuable, even with its frustrations. Human dignity matters.
And his attempt to ground it empirically. The sole evidence that is possible to produce that anything is desirable is that people do actually desire it.
Controversial, perhaps, but it shows his effort to connect ethics to actual human psychology, what we demonstrably want.
And lastly, summarizing the justice argument. Justice is a name for certain classes of moral rules, which concern the essentials of human well-being more nearly.
Right. It highlights that justice isn't separate from utility, but the most crucial foundational part of utility, protecting that essential security we all need.
So how does this play out in, you know, real life? How can we apply these ideas?
Well, personally, it encourages you to think longer term about your choices. Maybe choosing a career or even a hobby, not just for immediate fun, but for how it contributes to your growth, your higher pleasures, and maybe the well-being of others, too.
Like choosing the challenging project over the easy one because it builds skills and maybe helps more people.
Exactly. Or even small things like engaging with complex issues instead of just seeking passive entertainment. It's about optimizing for long-term flourishing.
And in the public sphere, for governments or policies.
Oh, it's huge there. Utilitarian thinking underpins so much policy debate, often implicitly. When governments weigh the costs and benefits of a new regulation or decide how to spend public money on healthcare versus education,
they're trying to figure out what brings the biggest overall benefit.
Ideally, yes. They're making a calculation, sometimes explicit, sometimes not, about which path maximizes overall welfare or minimizes overall harm for the largest number of people. Think about criminal justice reform shifting from pure retribution towards deterrence and rehabilitation that's often justified on utilitarian grounds, arguing it leads to better long-term outcomes for society.
It also seems like the foundation for things like effective altruism, people trying to figure out how to do the most good with their resources.
Absolutely. That movement is deeply rooted in utilitarian principles. The idea that you should use evidence and reason to figure out how your actions, your donations, your time can have the greatest positive impact on well-being, considering everyone equally, that's Mill's principle, applied systematically.
Okay, so wrapping up, what's your big takeaway from revisiting Mill? Anything surprise you this time?
For me, it's always striking how much Mill emphasized the role of feelings in education. You expect utilitarianism to be cold calculation, but he grounds it so deeply in our cultivated social sentiments, our capacity for empathy, our desire for unity. It makes the theory much richer and, frankly, more human than its reputation suggests.
Yeah, I agree. That was my main insight, too. It's not just a spreadsheet. There's a real psychological depth there.
And maybe a final thought, something provocative for you, the listener, to mull over. Mill really believed moral progress was possible, driven by reason and evidence applied to human well-being. So the challenge he leaves us with is, if we really rigorously applied his test to our current laws, our institutions, our social norms, asking honestly, does this truly maximize the security and the highest flourishing for the greatest number? How much would need to change?
That's a big question. It definitely reframes a lot of current debates.
It really does.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.